There comes a time in each man's life when he can't even believe his own eyes.
It's Manson Mitchell on the Weekend with Gary Manson, Suzanne Mitchell. A double shot of good conversation with great guests to power up your day. Manson Mitchell, you're on the air.
Thank you, Eric Kramer. Hi, everybody. Happy weekend to you. I'm Gary Mance.
I'm Suzanne Mitchell.
And I'm sitting here as part of Manson Mitchell. Suzanne is wearing just the neutral white, whereas I am wearing the deep blue of the Seattle Kraken. I've got my swag on in order to say a proper hello to he who keeps us on an even keel. He makes sure we're still skating along. Of course, I'm talking about Nathan Miller. How are you, Nathan?
Doing great, Gary and Suzanne. And looking outside, looks like a really good day. Dense fog out there to go outside. Spooky weather for some Sasquatch hunting. And if you're looking for a Bigfoot, it's not me. I might be tall, but my feet are tiny.
Now, that's something that I was only informed of this yesterday at the end of another show that I do called American Road Trip Talk, heard on 1150 KKNW as well as in podcast form, but it broadcasts live 1 p.m. Pacific time every Friday. Nathan is the producer, all hail. And at the end of yesterday's broadcast, I don't know how we got on the sub. Maybe I said Bigfoot. That might have been it. But Nathan, now you, how tall are you? Like 6'6"?
6'6". That's correct.
6 foot, 6 inches. So a guy like you, I'm going to guess you got to be like, speaking of Bigfoot, I'm thinking that you're like size 15, shoe 15 and a half. What do you say?
Well, subtract 4 sizes. I'm like a 10 and a half, 11 at best.
Really?
Interesting. Little tiny feet.
Wow, that is interesting. A basketball player ever?
Nah, that was too easy.
Too easy. There you go.
But of course, it would help if I could jump, which I can't do very well. So I stuck to baseball and played the hot corner.
Small feet. You can't jump on those small feet.
Another remarkable factoid regarding Nathan Miller.
Nathan, you're just a one of a kind, that's for sure.
An outlier at that.
Yes, indeed. But we're so happy to have you with us every Saturday. We do get into some fun topics here on this broadcast, which we've been doing for 15 years. And we do it on the strength of, I think, versatility and variety. Because today we're going to talk about Sasquatch, aka Bigfoot. And we brought in someone whom I regard as one of those. And Suzanne and I have a lot of these, don't we? Tom Yamarone, who joins us momentarily, is a man I consider to be a friend. I just haven't met him face to face. And I'm not counting Zoom, right? So at some point, wouldn't it be great to be somewhere in traditional Bigfoot country and meeting up with Tom Yamarone? He'll probably bring his guitar with him.
That would be fun. He has the songs.
He does. He's a balladeer. He's a Bigfoot balladeer, and he performs and writes other music as well, but he is famous for his Bigfoot ballads. I'm going to read his mad props here, Suzanne, and then we'll get him on, and we're going to talk us some Sasquatch today.
All right.
Tom Yamarone is a singer-songwriter from Livermore, California, who has been actively investigating the Bigfoot Sasquatch phenomenon for over 15 years. His search for proof of Sasquatch involves acquiring audio and photographic evidence and firsthand accounts. Tom also attempts to educate the amateur researchers in the proper documentation of possible Bigfoot evidence. He has organized several major conferences in California and Washington. The history of Bigfoot research is a passion of his. This has inspired him to compose and perform songs about Bigfoot in tribute to these historic figures and accounts in the Sasquatch lore. Tom is also chairman of the board of directors for the Alliance of Independent Bigfoot Researchers. Everybody goes corporate. In 2014, Tom made his big screen debut in Bobcat Goldthwait's Bigfoot film, Willow Creek. So it is our pleasure to welcome, it's been a while, but we welcome back the wonderful Tom Yamarone. Tom, how are you today, sir?
Good morning, Gary and Suzanne. Doing fine. That's a great, wow, it's a nice bio.
Well, thanks. I'm glad you wrote it and sent it to us because it makes it such a succinct way of bringing you into our fold once again. As I say, it's been a long time. Gosh,
it has been. I do resemble those remarks, too.
Tom, let me ask you, I want to just get right into this. I'm just skidding on the ice here. It's so wintry, except we live in Florida and we really don't get that. But the sun shines a little bit less this time of year. I wanted to say, it would be great to be out with you, Tom, out in Sasquatch country. And there have been sightings in Florida, y'all. It's true.
That's right.
But if we were going out together and we heard the calls of Bigfoot, unless it was Bigfoot researchers calling each other, because that could always happen. It would be kind of a comical moment. Would I be with somebody in you, Tom? Would I be accompanying someone who has either had a direct personal Bigfoot sighting or been perhaps with a big hair's breadth, Bigfoot size of actually having your own encounter? Or are you one of those guys that's been sort of in the, on the, not the periphery so much, I'm talking about being in the vicinity without having that direct personal experience?
Right. Well, I think either way it could happen, as long as you're out in country, in the forest, or edge of the forest, along a waterway. You know, you put yourself in country in that situation and just hope for the best.
And you hope for the best.
Optimistic. You hope for the best, but you know that's pretty much what we do. Just go out and camp, go out into historic areas, and look and listen for sign, and then try to record that. And the times I have recorded sounds, I've put them up on my YouTube channel, Bigfoot Songs 04, as possible sounds. And with sounds, you know, you don't hear it, you don't see it making the sounds, but it's just the area you're in and the situation you're in.
You know, Tom, it's been a while since we've talked to you. And I was saying right before we got on air that Gary and I haven't done a lot of paranormal in the last few years, and no Bigfoot since we had you on last. And so my question was, since it's been a few years, is there any progress being made in filming Bigfoot or audio or video that is very compelling to you, say in the last 5 years, something new on the scene?
You know, I get little clips now and then from my friend Cliff Berrickman, who was on the show Finding Bigfoot, is on the show, and they'll get little clips now and then, and he'll send me screen captures or describe what he's seen. And so there have been game cameras that have captured Bigfoot, or I don't know that anyone's filmed it like Patterson and Gimlin did back in 67, actually filmed it. But, you know, people have set up game cameras and they've been successful.
So many ways to go with this as our trailhead.
So the pictures are actually have gotten better because of the cameras that have been out there in the forest?
Well, yeah, I mean, better in the sense that I think the Patterson-Gimlin film is great, actually, in terms of quality, what you can see in it. But the things Cliff has showed me have shown creatures that are of huge size, walking upright, swinging their arms, you know, things that we look, you would say, are typical Bigfoot characteristics.
So and you're going to swear
as good as the Patterson-Gimlin film.
Well, the Patterson-Gimlin is actually a film, but you know, when you're looking at a screenshot, is it possible that it's just a guy in a gorilla suit?
Well, no, in that sense, it depends really where they got it and what was going on, but they do comparisons. So they go and compare, they put Bobo out there where the subject is and take a comparison photo.
Now that would be interesting. And we've had Bobo on this show. I have gotten acquainted with that gentleman, and we love us some Bobo, just like we love you, Tom. I'm curious to know.
It's great to have him as a friend.
Oh, you're privileged. We all are. He's a wonderful guy. I want, and a first-rate researcher too, I might add, and his Bigfoot call, Sasquatch vocalizations are the stuff of legend in and of themselves. Here's what I wanted to ask you, Tom. I set aside my own intense curiosity about Bigfoot and the Patterson-Gimlin film particularly, and let me ask it from a different angle.
Okay.
I'm wondering if you've had this kind of experience, because you get around, you talk to all these people, you're on TV, there was a movie, and you were one of the stars of it, Willow Creek. Do you have people that come up to you and say, how did you get that guy you got in that costume to move his arms so realistically? I mean, I see the folds of it, so I know it's a costume. Yeah, it's fake, but how did you get all these people over these decades to actually believe that was a Bigfoot? Who was directing that film anyway?
No, you know, the best evidence, I think, and analysis that's come out has been by Bill Munns, a former a Hollywood creature effects person, looked at the Patterson film and gave his analysis in a book, When Roger Met Patty. And there he just goes, you know, throughout the film, and he went and found all the existing copies of the film and determined that, indeed, it's not a person in a suit, because, you know, you would have had to have handlers and caretakers, and you would have had to do multiple takes. And so Bill Munns really gives the best analysis of the Patterson-Gimlin film. And so it's not a person in a costume. And that person that came forward and claimed he was the Bigfoot, you know, he's just not a straightforward guy.
A little publicity hound, huh?
More or less. Well,
you know, as a matter of fact, Tom, to take this a bit further, many years ago, there was a track star from the University of Washington who agreed to be filmed covering a stretch of terrain, running as fast as he could. This kid was a track star.
Right.
And yet when the gait, the stride, the power of the creature, the presumed creature on the Patterson-Gimlin film, was juxtaposed with the running of this track star out in the woods in Bigfoot country,
if you will. I think that was the Memorial Day footage up at that lake in northern Washington.
Yes.
And they had him run across the hillside, but he was unable to match it.
And he was running fast. He's an athlete in great condition,
right,
but the gait, the stride, the distance covered just didn't match.
That's right.
And the other thing is, in the presumed Bigfoot of the Patterson-Gimlin film didn't seem, I watched it, I go, this creature doesn't seem to be in any big hurry, right?
No, it walked with a purpose, but it strode. And they were able to cast 10 footprints. Patterson cast 2 that day, and then a man named Bob Titmus went out a week later and cast another 8. And so in that sense, you have 10 footprints from one sighting film, you know, which are just great. And Jeff Meldrum put them all together in a talk. And he's an anatomist from Idaho State University who's interested in Bigfoot and wrote the book When Legend Meets Science.
Oh, wow. That's what I need to read.
You know, Tom, I don't know if we've talked about this before. Gary and I were talking this morning about our interview today. And one of the things that came up was the idea of the name of the creature, because it's been sighted all over the world,
right?
You know, up in the Himalayas and everywhere. It seems to have multiple names. Where did the Sasquatch name come from? And why do we have a tendency to call it Bigfoot?
The Sasquatch came from the Chehalis tribe in British Columbia. And there was a man, C.W. Burns, who was bringing stories out of that reservation or out of the First Nations land. He was a teacher there. And there they had a mask. And it's Seskets is what the word they used was, Seskets. And so someone just anglicized it into Sasquatch. But in fact, we did a tribute to John Green, an author from that area, and the tribe came and did a dance for us with their Seskets mask. And it's one of my Bigfoot videos, or my videos on Bigfoot Songs 04. So it's really interesting where it came from. And then Jerry Crew, who I wrote a song about, met his sons and, you know, told the story of his 1958, October 1958 footprint casting. And in fact, when he took it to Eureka and showed a newspaper editor, Jerry was the one that said, let's call it Bigfoot.
Oh, so it was actually named by somebody in journalism, in the media.
Well, Jerry wants to claim that. So it was a bulldozer operator who got the first cast.
Okay.
His son wanted me to point that out. Yeah. not this man Genzoli, but in Northern California, in Humboldt County, there were a lot of accounts. Betty Allen, a reporter, was writing about Bigfoot accounts from the Humboldt County area.
But, if you were going to have Bigfoot Cruz country, that would be one of the places you would look. In fact, Tom, if I recall correctly, there is a Bigfoot loop. I'm not sure if it has an official designation, but if you go to Northern California, into Oregon, into Washington, and of course up into BC,
right,
there is a Bigfoot trail where if somebody wanted to make a road trip, you could fashion that as a Bigfoot research trip, or just being on the trail of Sasquatch, and you would follow a loop that takes you through some gorgeous country, even in the vicinity of national parks.
Right. Or I know in California they have a Bigfoot, they designated a Bigfoot scenic byway along Highway 96 from Willow Creek up to the town of Yreka on Interstate 5. So, right, you could take Interstate 5 and then get off and come down to Willow Creek along Highway 96, and you would be on the Bigfoot Scenic Highway.
You were saying earlier that Bigfoot has been sighted everywhere, including Florida, where I think they call it something else.
The skunk ape, right.
The skunk ape, yes.
The Myakka skunk ape. We live not too far away from there, by the way.
Right. We live close to where the Myakka skunk ape was sighted.
I didn't smell
it. But do you feel like there is a preponderance of certain areas, like you're talking about the highway on the West Coast? Do you think that there are more in one area than another, more in one country than another?
I think there's more in certain areas. Like I know in eastern Oklahoma, you have the Wachita Mountains or Wachitas. And there they have a rainforest situation where this North American Wood Ape Conservancy has compiled a huge amount of data. In fact, they even got a tracker onto one in a really keen way. Now, there's a show on Amazon Prime called Small Town Monsters, Sasquatch on the Trail of Sasquatch, and there they document the research done at the North American Wood Ape Conservancy. And up in Washington, you have the Olympic Project on the Olympic Peninsula. So there are certain areas where you would think there's concentrations of Bigfoots.
Well, do you think it's the woods, the water? What do you think that attracts them to certain areas?
I think it's a combination of forage and food and water. John Green used to speculate that any area with had a certain average annual rainfall over a couple hundred inches would be prime habitat. And so you have Washington, Oregon, Northern California, those areas. And I've been lucky to travel to those areas and to camp in the Mount St. Helens region. Was one summer where we camped there for a week, and was a wonderful place just to see. And then that's the Gifford Pinchot National Forest.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The signage for which you can see when you're heading on I-5 South, for example, you know it's out there. I don't know about Bigfoot, but you know that the National Forest is. Please, let's take a moment. We've got a little time here, Tom. When you made that camping trip and you were out in that area, you and the bare fact of nature and perhaps Bigfoot, how did you provision yourselves? Who took charge, and what was the scientific, if indeed there was, a scientific protocol for doing some serious research that might find itself into a magazine, a journal, or on TV?
Well, I know a woman we camped with from Texas had set up game cameras outside of our camp, and we camped at a dispersed or a remote campground in the Gifford Pinchot. And each night, we just all brought our food. And then we would have sort of like a potluck dinner, or someone would take responsibility for the main course each night. And that's how we handled our food. And then each night we'd go out and do call blasting and recording. And people carried cameras. But that was it. And then, of course, if there was evidence located, we all had plaster and tape measures and things like that.
And this is just a little sidebar, but in terms of your planning and provisioning, didn't you have to make sure in a far more probable concern there. What did you do about keeping your food safe from the bears? Were you hanging it high up in a tree?
No, we kept it in our cars and locked the cars at night. I know that's dangerous for your car, but, you know, we didn't have any problems with bears. So we were good around camp. We didn't leave food out and open, you know, and then we locked it in the cars when we were gone.
Okay. That's I'm always curious about how people make these things happen. You're not making it up. You're trying to make something happen, and you're following wherever the evidence will lead.
Right.
That's I'll add, let me go take let's go out of that context into another one. We can look where people live. Okay, they've got, whether it's a cabin, it's their main residence, whatever. Have you heard from people, and I am begging the question here, heard from people who had something of a gift or a gifting relationship with a Sasquatch to the degree that they would leave out something for, it could be food, something to indicate their interest in encountering a Bigfoot, leaving them something, saying, here's a gift for you. We mean no harm. We are not hostile. Here is a food you might like. And right. Then I've heard stories of these residents going out the next day, maybe down to the end of a road where they get their mail, and there will be an arrangement of something like pine cones there, or an odd configuration of pieces of wood, something to indicate that something was there reciprocating in a particular way.
Right. Now, well, the one thing I do know like that is somebody was out camping and something was leaving feathers and things at the door of their tent overnight. And so when they'd get up in the morning, there'd be a gift of something on their mat in front of the tent.
Wow.
In your research, Tom, can you say what it is that the Sasquatch or Bigfoot likes to eat? Are they carnivores, herbivores?
Well, we'd say omnivore.
Omnivore, some of each?
Some of each, right. And so okay. If you're in an area that has berries, I know the one time we brought organic apples into Humboldt County, I bought them in Eureka. They were taken that night from our camp, near our campsite, near a place called Fish Lake near Bluff Creek. And it was an exciting night out there with Bobo and Robert Leiterman. And so now you have there the Bluff Creek Project. But I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Cliff Berkman has a museum south of Portland in Boring, Oregon, called the North American Bigfoot Center. I wanted to make sure to plug that and let people know they can go there if they want to see the current best evidence and speak with Cliff or his wife, Melissa.
Judging by the way he communicates on camera, it would be a pleasure to meet him. This establishment is located maybe around the Bigfoot Loop. Where would one go to have this experience?
Boring, Oregon, I believe, is south of Portland. Not sure how far. I need to Google map it, but I have it on my Google Maps as a saved location. The North American Bigfoot Center. They also have a web presence. I know Cliff has done a few video presentations on YouTube.
Tom, what is the explanation for why we don't find Bigfoot bones? We find the footprints, but we don't find any remnants of the actual creature itself.
Right. What do people say? When they're getting sick or they're injured, they drag themselves off to a remote location. Or people would speculate that they don't bury their dead, but they drag them into a cave, you know, that they think the forest that they habitate in quickly recover a body, you know, so they don't, same reason you haven't found like bear or mountain lion remains.
Now, I hadn't thought about that. I mean, people don't find skeletons of bears or mountain lions out in the wild?
Not that I know of. I have never seen one. I've seen deer. I've seen the prey animals, but the predators, not that I've even been that far through the forest. You know, I'm usually on a trail or a road, but.
Right.
That is very interesting that there would be places so remote that that's where bears and Sasquatch and large animals would go.
One high-level consideration would be the principle, which is demonstrated every day around the world, nature reclaims its own.
Right, right. I think they did experiments with that, left the carcass out and then kept the camera on it, and how many days it took for, you know, the small animals, the scavengers, and then the small animals will eat the bones.
Okay. Yeah, and also if we're talking about, and we're being hypothetical, but if we talk about an apex predator that, according to the accounts and some of the research, seems to be the kind of predator that displays an unusual degree of intelligence.
Right.
So if there's anything like a Bigfoot society, how, no matter how dispersed, how far scattered they may be, they would have their own way, as it were, of doing business.
Right. Well, you know, you would think that this, people have always would say, where is he or she? You know, it's not just one. This is a breeding, you know, not a widespread, but definitely is a varied population. And you see that in the footprint evidence, the different lengths and widths, you know, the different footprint casts that people find. So you do think it's a varied population, you know.
Let's go ahead and take our break now. Tom, please hold that thought. I want to get into the cast, the prints, when we come back. And there's plenty of other stuff to discuss when the subject is Sasquatch, Bigfoot, by whatever name it is designated. It is a continuing mystery and one that enthralls millions of people around the world, actually.
Yes.
We're talking with Tom Yamarone. He is our honored guest of this hour. Give us a couple of minutes and we'll come back and continue this very intriguing conversation. And I believe coming back, we're going to get to hear a little bit of Tom Yamarone music. You can look forward to that. We are Manson Mitchell and you are tuned into AM 1150. We'll be right back.
Hi, everybody. This is Anson Williams from Happy Days, and I'm so excited to tell you about American Road. It is the best car travel magazine in the world. They have the most fantastic adventures detailed in each magazine with all your itinerary. We could just jump in the car with your family and have the most fabulous adventures you've ever had in your life. Please get a copy of American Road and start your own adventure.
Staying connected with Gary Mance and Suzanne Mitchell is easy. Just go to manceandmitchell.com for the latest info on topics and guests. Friend Gary Mance and Suzanne Mitchell on their Facebook pages and like the Mance and Mitchell show page at facebook.com/manceandmitchell. If you're on Twitter, share a follow with Gary and Suzanne at Mance Mitchell. Join Gary and Suzanne Friday and Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. for an unusual show that covers everything from personal growth to the paranormal.
Here's an amazing act. Here's a tremendous act. Here's a startling act. The amazing, the thrilling, the greatest, spectacular, incredible, exciting, wonderful, world fame, most unusual novelty act.
The home of the A-Team of Alternative Talk is manceandmitchell.com. Heard right here on Alternative Talk 1150 a.m. or streaming live from your computer anywhere.
Terry Loving wants to help you with your online marketing challenges right now. She has several courses she is giving away to help you get your business working for you online. Yes, giving away. WordPress websites are her specialty, yet her technical skills go way beyond that. Check out her blog at terryloving.com or email her directly at terry@terryloving.com. That's terry@terryloving.com.
I'm Gary Mance.
I'm Suzanne Mitchell.
We're a couple of baby boomers who bring you a talk radio mix of metaphysics and music, politics, and pop culture.
And you never know which celebrity will join us for an interesting conversation.
Mance and Mitchell is Boomer HQ, Friday and Saturday mornings at 10 on 1150 AM KKNW.
Your home for alternative talk in Seattle and Western Washington.
Multicultural, multidimensional even. Alternative Talk 1150.
Welcome back to Manson Mitchell. And that music that you're hearing is by Tom Yamarone, our guest today, Bigfoot Songs. And he has more than one.
Free advice here, Tom. Don't let Bob Dylan get his hands on that because it'll come out sounding like Roger and Bob went down to the creek. Lost in their thug, not a lot to say.
The Bob Dylan of Bigfoot Songs, which was quite a remarkable
that is
comparison.
True.
Of course, Bob Dylan is incredible, but no, that's great. That's the Yamarone Brothers Band version, too. Bobo got a band in Sacramento to back me up on some demos.
Oh, that's wonderful. And you sent me that CD years ago. Bless you. I still have it. Excellent stuff. We're talking about Bigfoot, in case you didn't notice. Sasquatch, Bigfoot, so much to say. In the social media, Tom, I put out that we're going to be talking about classic cases and familiar faces in the lore of Bigfoot. In particular, and this is also by way of tribute, Tom, so say whatever you want to say about an esteemed scientist and apparently one heck of a gentleman. He was so deeply respected by the name of John Bindernagel. That's how I pronounce his surname anyway.
John Bindernagel. I have his book right here in front of me. He was an incredible man and just a great, great scientist who devoted his life to wildlife biology and Sasquatch. And with John and John Green, you always wanted to say Sasquatch and not Bigfoot. But John Bindernagel was one of those men you just enjoyed any time you got to spend with him. And in the recently when Bob Saget passed, I recalled that we had been up in Washington with him in the Olympic Peninsula on a weekend in 2010. And John Bindernagel had come down with his wife and was at a lodge up in Port Angeles. And we got to go up and spend the evening with him one night. And John Bindernagel has a book, Sasquatch, North America's Great Ape. It was his first book. And his second book was How Science Regards Sasquatch. But in it, he breaks down the different behaviors and what is not commonly known, but what is known from reports that you can glean from different accounts, eyewitness accounts. And so, you know, as I look at his book now, I see he details how they're known to swim up the upright stance. The anatomical characteristics, the body shape, etc. And John was one where I once went and found an old historic article from here in the Bay Area of California in the Antioch Ledger from 1906 and found it on the archives and sentiment. But there they had this place south of us on the way to Los Angeles. You drive by Orestimba Creek, and up in the mountains above San Jose, or south of San Jose, there's this mountainous range, oak trees and habitat like that. And there people would go deer hunting in the fall, and they would see these creatures. And they would describe them just as we know modern-day Bigfoots, you know. And they found footprints, and they had sightings. And so John wanted me to get a copy of the article from the Antioch Ledger. And anyway,
and that's going back to 1906.
He's on
that
YouTube,
leads
too, by the way. If you
I'm
Google
sorry?
Him or find him on YouTube, search for John Bindernagel has a channel.
John Bindernagel. He has a channel, you mean on YouTube?
Yes.
Okay, beautiful. In your assessment and from your friendship with the man, and no doubt some very heavy conversations you had with John Bindernagel, did this gentleman feel that, speaking largely, the world of science, anybody who would be even interested in delving into this, did they do Sasquatch justice in the way investigations over the years have been conducted?
I think John felt that science didn't do its due diligence in investigating the subject as it should have. I think he felt like it was not overlooked, but no one wanted to embrace it or touch it. You know, it would hurt their careers. But, I mean, he was a man, as I read the bio on the back of his book, 30 years of field experience, served as the wildlife advisor for the United Nations projects in East Africa, Iran, and the Caribbean, and Belize. I mean, he was just a well-traveled, well-spoken man in his presentations, too. I remember seeing him, my first conference was in Willow Creek in 2003, where I first met and bought John's book. But just an incredible man, and his wife, too, Joan Bindernagel, who they both, may they rest in peace, are no longer with us, but just incredible people. And anyway, John Bindernagel is somebody we should always champion and mention every time I'm on. Hey, I think he joined us once or twice.
Yes, he did. Yes, he once did. At least.
Yeah.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Fine. It takes a lot. I mean, people, I'm sure most people are aware. We all know what it is to risk embarrassment over something about which we are passionate or something that we strongly believe.
Right.
But I, as much as for anything else, I admire John Bindernagel for his willingness. I mean, the title of his first book was what again?
North America's Great Ape, the Sasquatch.
Now, if you're just going to come out with that, and you've got your research and whatever photos, drawings, what have you, and you put a title like that on it, there are people, I would wager, in the scientific community who would either offer some token comment, they might even disparage it, but they would be loath to endorse even excellent research that pointed in the direction of the existence of this great ape in North America, because people feel like their careers are on the line.
Right. Or the furtherment of your career is on the line.
Certainly.
Tom, I have not read that book, America's Great Ape, the Sasquatch.
Right.
In that book or in anything else that you've read, has it been opined that the great ape, America's Great Ape, the Sasquatch, is actually an evolving species here on planet Earth, which is not actually an ape, but not actually a human being, that it is something in between that just evolved in a way that has kept it from, you know, unifying into the regular human society or the ape society. It's not in either one. It's doing its own thing.
I think it's something where people who've encountered him, I was just reading one of the great early encounters by a man named William Rowe. And then that he spoke about how he had his rifle trained on it, but it showed such human characteristics that there was no way he would be able to shoot it and take its life, even though he knew if he was to obtain a specimen of the Sasquatch, it would be quite invaluable. But I think people talk about the human characteristics of him. And there's others who want to say they're more human than ape. And it seems like it's a combination that we don't see in nature, you know, of upright, bipedal, hominid.
Right.
Hair covered. But so, you know, that's always the conundrum, I think, for some folks. Is it human or is it an ape?
Right. And we've talked about, you know, the missing link with Charles Darwin and humans evolved from apes. And I'm not certain that that's true, but it was a theory that first came apes, then came humans. And I'm thinking, well, is it possible that out of apes, there came two types of species, two types of being, one being the hairless one and one being the hairy one. And maybe they both evolved.
Orangutan branch of evolution, the Sasquatch. You know, and they think that it came to North America when the Bering Strait land bridge was there and it migrated over with other mammals.
Well, that is very curious.
Here's a question I haven't asked anyone in a while. Are there researchers who have been successful in establishing something of a lineage, and it really speaks to a worldwide dispersal, not to mention altitude there, but are there Bigfoot researchers who see strong similarities between the Sasquatch ape and the Yeti of the Himalayas, the abominable snowman?
Yes, I think there is a connection there between the Yeti, the Yeren in China, in the Alma of Russia. But, you know, you do see a connection of the different lineages, that there's characteristics that are the same as the North American Sasquatch or Bigfoot. But, you know, there's not just one species. It's a variety of different variations or, you know.
Well, in the same way that even in the human population, you have various colors of people, yellow, brown, black, white,
right,
red. You have different different kinds of human beings. Why wouldn't you have different kinds of great apes, Sasquatch? That makes sense to me.
Right. Someone asked me the other day, do you think Sasquatch is affected by the pandemic? And I didn't really have an answer. I thought, well, they stay quite far away from humans, so I don't
I would think that it would be just human to human, but it also might mean if there was a pandemic among that species, whether it be Sasquatch or cats or birds. I mean, you had the avian flu.
Right.
I mean, you had different types, so maybe they would just get their own. You know, when I think about all the various kinds of things that live here on this planet, and each one has its own society. We have the human society. We have the ant society. Now, the ants have very little interaction with the humans. They're doing their thing. They're going underground. They're building ant hills. They have an ant queen. They have a society that doesn't really connect with our society. And so when you think about that, or you think about the lions and tigers, you know, the wild cats, they've got, you know, they're doing their breeding, they're living, they're hunting, they're eating, they're sleeping. It isn't as though, you know, if they see a human, then that human still isn't in their society. It's a strange animal from another society. And so I say to myself, there is a case to be made that the Sasquatch definitely are in existence, and they have their own society that really doesn't interact with humans that much, just like the ape society wouldn't interact with humans that much unless we're, you know, hunting them in Africa.
Right, or on an eco tour on Mount Kilimanjaro, right.
There you go. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of different kinds of beings that live on planet Earth. It doesn't mean that we're necessarily going to interact with them all. Now, that being said, we'd like to. You know, we look for them, we call out to them, we hope they call back. You know, we're trying to get pictures, we're trying to get evidence. And, you know, I'm just wondering, you know, we've managed successfully to find lots of other plants and lots of other animals. So, you know, is it possible that we will actually make a connection with the Sasquatch at some point?
I think when I watched that documentary on the Trail of Sasquatch by Small Town Monsters, they came to the conclusion that in order to prove this, you're going to have a specimen. So the North American Wood Ape Conservancy, that is their goal, is to kill one and present it to science.
Wow. I would have some moral qualms about that.
Yeah, just like the guy with the gun that couldn't shoot it. It was right. acting human, and he said he couldn't shoot it because it was acting human-like.
And that was from what right. year, do you recall? What era?
Oh, the 1955, I think, William Rowe.
1955. There, it was probably less than 100 years earlier, and as societies go, that's quite a bit of time. But nevertheless, there was a time in this country where one of the vacation sports, if you took the rails, if you wanted to go by rail across the plains, you were actually, in some instances, allowed to shoot at buffalo from these rolling cars of a train for sport. It's you're in their territory. You're on their turf, as it were. This is their indigenous territory there. And yet people would shoot these animals. They fell it as the train just keeps rolling along. So there is a moral dimension when it comes to seeking a different species, trying to provide evidence without actually having to take its life. I just think that would be a terrible thing to do.
Right. Well, they explain it pretty well in this documentary, why they feel that. And my good friends, Kathy and Bob Strain, are part of that project. So, you know, I know what you're saying. It does seem sad that you have to kill one to prove it to science, but that's all that science is going to accept is proof. So it wow, really comes back to, do you want to prove they exist? And to prove they exist, you then protect their habitat.
Protect their habitat. I can see where this would be a very controversial discussion in the highest circles of biology, wildlife biology, conservation, ecology,
cryptozoology,
and certainly cryptozoology, where, you know, they want to get their hands on something that isn't, as one person described it, a gut pile from maybe a bear, and they're passing it off as Bigfoot. So there is that endless desire to know and to verify, and you have to be of a certain type of scientist, a certain type of researcher, where you have to look at the trade-off. That's really an ethical dilemma, Tom.
It's really well done. Seth Breedlove is the filmmaker of On the Trail of Sasquatch. And I believe I saw it on Amazon Prime. And it's really well done. He gets the members of the North American Wood Ape Conservancy to explain, you know, why that's their goal. And so I think it helps to watch that if people have that ability to stream that movie.
I'm going to be looking it up. I would like to watch that. I would like that very much, as a matter of fact. Color me intrigued. So let me use that as a jumping off point here while we still have several minutes, Tom. I have watched, and I want to say it was the Discovery Channel. I might be wrong about that, but I seem to recall I saw it on Discovery. There were scientists that went deep into the Great North Woods.
Right.
And they established their cave. They weren't in tents. Maybe they had some tents with them, but they were in a dwelling. Yeah, I think you know which one I'm talking about.
The cabin where, on Monster Quest, where the thing stepped on the screws on the pad on the front
door?
Well,
yeah, and did a pretty good job of trashing their porch. And there were rocks in the middle of the night. There were rocks being thrown that landed on the roof of this dwelling far from civilization.
Right.
I'd like to hear some about that. What's your impression of all that?
The guys were really scared, actually, that night, the crew.
I would be one of them. that's for sure. I mean, in the middle of the night, imagine, you know, and you got security cameras and the lights going off. You go out there, or perhaps the next morning, and you see the patio is just trashed. Well, that could be a bear that didn't like any humans around. You know, it was a reaction.
At their metal roof, and it was intimidating inside, and outside they were growling and thrashing trees. You know, they were around the cabin all night.
So here's a creature. Intimidating, and here's a creature with the mental wherewithal, however their brains work. They have the mental wherewithal to see this as a threat, don't want it, this is an incursion, and they will pick up something that is used as a weapon and hurl it at a dwelling to warn them away, to scare people off. That's a high order kind of intelligent behavior, it seems to me.
Well, I know. I remember speaking to hunters in the Sierra Nevada mountains here in California who were up a certain isolated valley and had a large rock lobbed at them, came bouncing in near them, you know, came arching through the air. And they realized, what could throw a rock? You know, what has hands and thumbs? And so they just realized, turn around and leave.
Good plan. Yeah,
I'm sure that's what I would do. Yeah, if I had a rock thrown at me in the middle of the forest.
So in terms of the Bigfoot lore there, and I do believe this goes back to, if not Pioneer Day, certainly the days where Sasquatch culture and Bigfoot as it came to be known, there was an intersection where they met. It might have been a collision of sorts. But there are tales going way back about this kind of anger on the part of a Sasquatch, the hostile actions where the intention to be left alone and to scare away intruders or potential high-order predators was very evident from the way they behaved. I think a lot of that is in the literature, right?
Yeah, I think there's accounts, too, of people seeing trees that are swaying back and forth with no wind in the area, you know, just trees thrashing around. And I know of two accounts from Washington when this guy was a friend was a young man and being out in a field, and all of a sudden the trees at the edge of the field began to sway back and forth, thrashing, you know.
Have there been speculations done, in addition to the strength of the Sasquatch and the size of the Sasquatch, has there been anybody who has speculated about their other senses? Can they smell people before we smell them? And apparently there is quite an odor coming from Sasquatch that we as humans are able to pick up. Is there anything about their hearing or seeing that might be better or less than what we have? Has anybody done any research about that?
Well, I don't know if they've done research, but I think people speculate that you don't want to, you know, overdo your cologne or perfume before going out. You know, you want to sort of get back to being a little more natural, and that they would smell you, you know, on the wind, I guess.
Okay.
In addition to which, there's the more practical.
They don't seem to mind, although people do indicate it's a really overwhelming odor.
I've said before that unless you're hearing a cry, which, you know, can be debated in and of itself, is this a Bigfoot vocalization? If you are out there, many people have indicated that they smelled the creature before they ever saw it.
Right. Or they think it's a reaction to being excited or anger. You know, a gland secretes an odor.
Have there been any vocalizations that were more than just yells or cries out loud? Anything that would be significantly different enough that you might say there's a language somewhere?
Well, the Sierra sounds recorded by Ron Moorhead and Al Berry in the Sierras in the early 70s recorded what they would call it was sort of like a samurai chatter is what they called it, you know, and it was a language like that. So those are great sounds to listen to for recordings that aren't just screams and howls.
Yeah, very interesting.
It is indeed there. And just in our last minute here, Tom, where is all the TV coverage going next? Are you aware of some projects coming where they're going to take this a step further? Is there new programming on the way regarding Bigfoot?
Not that I know of. I know there's a show on that isn't getting really great reviews. I still watch Finding Bigfoot when it comes on, the review, mm-hmm. the repeats of that.
If people would like to connect with you, Tom, is the best way to look for your music on YouTube, Tom Yamarone Music, or how
yes,
should they do
YouTube
that?
YouTube is the best way to see what I've done musically and my research.
And your research. Great. And Tom Yamarone, Yamarone, Tom Yamarone.
Yes.
Look him up. Find
Bigfoot
out more
song
about Bigfoot.
04 is my channel.
And once again,
all one
Bigfoot
word.
Bigfoot Songs 04 is the YouTube channel.
Yes.
Tom, we knew we were going to have some fun on this Saturday, and you brought the fun with you and a lot to think about with regard to the Sasquatch.
Well, it's been my honor, my pleasure. I'd love talking with you guys. So let's do this again.
Oh, guaranteed. And I love a guest that has such a good time, he invites himself back. You're my kind of guy, Tom. I'm telling you, it's always a pleasure for us as well. Thank you, Tom Yamarone, and we will do this again.
Thank you, Gary and Suzanne. Have a great day. And thank you, Nathan, at KKNW.
There you go. And stay tuned for Jupiter Rising.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll be back next Friday right here on AM 1150. Have yourselves a great weekend in the meantime.